Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, last week, I was talking to my uncle a little bit. We did a little discussion on oysters. And while we were having the conversation, because he's living out in Long Island, and he's been approached to farm some oysters off of his property on the water. Mm-hmm. But we were just talking about business in general and how things are going. And one of the things he asked me was, so are you seeing the same food price increases in your business that I'm seeing in the King Cullen? And what I said to him is, while I'm seeing huge cost increases in my business, most of those are in energy.
Fuel.
That's where most of those are in labor. Most of those are in other places. In a business like ours, we're not seeing those big increases. The farmer who has been sustainably farming his corn, even for instance, mm-hmm. it costs 60 cents an ear or 70 cents an ear, and it still costs 60 cents an ear or 70 cents an ear because the practices that he's implemented to grow that corn hasn't really changed all that much.
Well, because he's not using chemical fertilizer, which is expensive and dependent on, gets more mm-hmm. expensive with the price of oil. And, you know, trucking is not as big an issue for him. It's not as fuel-intensive a project.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I'm not seeing yet, knock on wood, the same price rises in food.
And we're seeing some small price rises. But again, if I'm buying grass-fed steaks from a sustainably produced farm, you know, those prices are just, you know, the price of grass didn't go up any. Yes, the price of getting the cow from here to there has gone up, but a lot of the influences that are increasing food prices across the country aren't affecting the organic market as much. As a matter of fact, it's making the prices come closer together.
But they are still affecting the restaurant.
Of course, absolutely.
Because what I am seeing is we're seeing, you know, we cook with fire. You know,
mm-hmm.
And we have to do a lot of heating and a lot of air conditioning and a lot of conditioning of the air of the kitchen and exchanging it with the outside air, exhausting smoke out of the kitchen and carbon dioxide out of the kitchen, and that's all gotten very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of insurance has gone through the roof,
mm-hmm.
and the cost of the other thing is there's a little charge added onto everything now. All these companies give you, you'll get the invoice, and even if it's delivered in their truck, there's a fuel surcharge.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, you know, no matter what you order, they write, you know, $35, you know,
right.
Fuel surcharge. And I just restaurants are feeling, and right now restaurants aren't going to be looking to raise their prices.
Well, that's
to their customers.
I think that's kind of an interesting point, and I think how this shakes out over the next year or so as we kind of go through this time, I think will be interesting to see how restaurants react. Now, Stage Left and Kath Lombardi are kind of established, and they're places that people go to, and you know, I hope and expect that things will continue on the upward trajectory that they've always been on. And there's a little bit more there where you could weather the storm, but you have a lot of restaurants out there that are living on the edge, and I'm sure as they live on the edge that increased costs and inability to raise your prices because people are feeling the crunch, it will have an impact on the types of restaurants you see.
Mm.
You know, we talked a while back about, you know, Craig Shelton's restaurant is not open anymore. You know, there was a big article in the Times a few weeks back about Florent is not open anymore. I think there are certain types of restaurants that maybe won't make it from here to there without, you know, unless there's a lot of stuff behind them.
Well, and you know, there's an old adage that you and I have subscribed to for over a decade now, which is, you know, we do consulting for other folks, but The best thing that you can do to ensure your restaurant's viability is to own the building it's in.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true.
And, you know, that gives us a tremendous, lets us breathe quite a lot easier. That's, sure. You know, if a restaurant is paying rent and falls behind on the rent or gets close to being able to make that rent payment and they're not also the landlord, it's an extra cushion that, you know, we have.
Right.
You know? I mean, we haven't had to use it yet, but,
right.
But you know, I don't lose sleep at night. Whereas some of the people we consult for, you know, they're on a, you know, you have three bad months in mm-hmm. a row and you're in a lot of trouble.
But the Ledger did an article recently on restaurants and how business is being affected. And one of the local restaurateurs in that article said, you know, I'm basically cutting anything that was for show. I've basically cut out any of those little extras that were more style than substance. I'm taking those things away. And I think that's just a trend you're going to see. You're going to see, except at the super high end. I think per se is going to be per se. And they're going to be able to do all the things that they've ever done. But I think for most of those, we'll call them New York Times 3-star restaurants, I think you're going to see a little bit of that, I'm going to try and give you things that offer you value. I'm going to try and give you things that enhance your dining experience, but maybe fewer of those things that enhance the visual experience or the how you feel while you're in the seat.
Well, and I hate to cheerlead for New Brunswick because I realize there's a national malaise in the marketplace right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, New Brunswick is an amazing town to be in. Thank heaven. It's a restaurant town. It's a restaurant destination. We have two large hotels in town mm-hmm. in walking distance to each other on either end of the downtown. One has just gone through a multi-million-dollar renovation, and the other one is brand new.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all happened in the last 2 years. So we're sort of fairly or unfairly insulated from this. But you know, and you know what? And in places like New York, where a lot of the money is foreign, the restaurants who appeal to an international clientele
right, are doing
also
very well.
Are doing fine.
Very well.
But, you know, I talk to people in the restaurants out on the highway, and mm-hmm. It's tough. It's tough. Even if their business isn't down, their costs are up, and they can't raise their prices.
You know, you just mentioned New Brunswick, and there was just something I was thinking about the other day that I just want to interject for a second. I realize where our restaurant is. I was just thinking about this the other day. Within about 120 feet of our restaurant, there is an Ethiopian restaurant, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Mexican restaurant,
which is
great. I had a woman from San Francisco come in the other day going, she was in one of the play next door, and she was like, what's going on here? There's a Mexican restaurant that's better than any of the Mexican restaurants in L.A., San Diego, mm-hmm. here in the middle of New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
There's an Indian restaurant. There's a Vietnamese restaurant.
This is walking down the block.
You have stage left is an American restaurant. Catherine Lombardi's an Italian restaurant. There's a pizzeria.
There's a Vietnamese restaurant.
There's a Vietnamese, like I just said. There's another American restaurant. I'm not 100 yards away from the restaurant yet.
Well, it's funny, that's one of the things that is New Brunswick's strength, and I think while the restaurants sort of view each other as competition, and we are competition for each other, but it's a healthy competition, and I think it makes the whole place. I'd rather be here.
For
I'd
sure.
I'd rather be here
for
than,
sure.
than out on the highway. I really, really would.
So,
where I'm the only restaurant
just,
in town.
Just, you know, dine out in New Brunswick. There's so much interesting going on in New Brunswick right now.
Well, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Taras Gresko. He's written articles on travel for The Times of London, The Independent, Condé Nast Traveler, National Geographic Traveler, and The New York Times. His current book is Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood.
Taras, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
You know, this book is a wonderful book because eating seafood ethically is actually kind of a challenging thing to do. And one of the things you say early on in your book is, you know, we have a lot of options, but one of them is not despair. And I think that when people who do try to eat ethically with regard to seafood, because it is sort of a complex issue. I mean, you had to write a book about it, right?
Yeah,
it,
totally.
You know, one of the ways people can react is say, you know what, I'm just not eating seafood. And another way people can react is say, you know what, I just can't keep track of this. Talk to us about your book and the inspiration for writing your book and how you eat.
Well, yeah, I became a seafood eater, a piscivore, about 14 years ago. And I switched from meat and poultry to eating mostly seafood, getting most of my protein from seafood. And at the time, it seemed like a really sensible choice. The oceans seemed bottomless. There was no real questions of endangered species in the oceans, apparently. But, as usual, my timing was impeccably bad. It turned out that the cod collapse was happening off the coast of Canada. So one of the biggest fish stocks in the world, which had been fished for 500 years, was fished to the brink, to commercial extinction.
Beyond the brink, unfortunately.
Beyond the brink, exactly. Well, I mean, they've been officially declared an endangered species, northern cod.
Talk to us about, because we allude to that devastating event often on the show, but I don't think people really understand what happened. What happened with the cod, and define what it means to say that the fishery collapsed?
Well, I mean, off the Grand Banks, off of Newfoundland, vessels had been coming over for 500 years, European vessels, and of course there was a big local fishery. Newfoundland fishermen were gradually using better and better technology, including pair trawling, where two trawlers would go out and tow a giant net behind them, scooping up all the fish in the water. And what they were doing, and little did they know it, they were taking out the big females, the big fecund females, which are actually the fish that produce the most eggs, and essentially they wiped out the spawning, the breeding population that way. So there are only a few cod left inshore around Newfoundland right now.
And the point being
that we can, an industrial fishery can actually wipe out the fish that it's targeting. The oceans aren't bottomless.
And well, the problem is the fish is not extinct, but there are not enough fish to bring that population back.
Yeah, and in the case of the cod, some of the fish that they once preyed on, little guys like the capelin, have actually taken their place in the food chain. So the only hope for the cod off of Newfoundland is that some kind of stock might migrate from the shores of Greenland or Iceland or something like that.
But what most people don't realize is when they say a fishery collapses, that's the point at which, even if you stop fishing it, which we've done, there's no more commercial fishing there, that doesn't mean that it's going to come back.
No, that's true. I mean, that is one area where I do despair a little bit, because we actually have reached the point where some fish are gone. There just isn't a big enough critical mass of them enough to restore the population. If we retreat before that happens, before we reach the point of commercial extinction, then the populations can rebound and do so quite nicely. I mean, off the shores of Florida, for example, there's a whole area that's been set aside off Cape Canaveral, just because NASA does its launches around there, and the fish are actually in really good shape there. So this is sort of the idea of marine reserves that's growing around the world.
For most of our fish, it's really not too late.
Yeah, exactly. The cod were a good
bellwether
lesson. Yeah, exactly. The thing is that a lot of the fish we're chasing around the globe right now, Chilean sea bass, they started fishing it off the coast of Chile when it was called Patagonian toothfish, and now they're chasing it to distant oceans. So there's a fishery in Antarctic waters off the shores of South Georgia. Our technology is so good, and the value of the fish goes up so much that it actually makes it worthwhile to chase it to distant Arctic and Antarctic waters. Well, Chilean sea bass can go for $1,000 a fish now.
Well, and in the sort of perverse way, and you know, people who worship the free market does not work with fish, because as a fish becomes closer and closer to extinction, it becomes rarer and rarer, and therefore more and more expensive, which is more and more imperative to fish it out of existence.
Yeah, it's happening with Caspian sturgeon caviar, for example. It's also happening with bluefin tuna. There is a point where the Japanese are actually concerned enough about toro, their native toro, which they bring in from the shores, from Atlantic shores as well, to start raising it in labs. So there's actually a system to raise it from the larval stage, and they're selling it in supermarkets and restaurants in Japan now.
Yeah, they're also doing some interesting things basically with tuna farming almost, where they're catching fish when they're relatively smaller and growing them in gigantic pens. And
yeah, in theory, I thought that might be a good idea, but I talked to some tuna biologists, and they were pointing out that they remove, this is a way of getting around the quotas.
Mm-hmm.
So every year, the ICAT,
right,
one of the management organizations, sets out a quota for Atlantic tuna. And this is a way of making the most of the quota, because you remove the smaller fish and you get tons of them, then you tow them very slowly to a tuna farm and fatten them up, so you're adding value to them. Unfortunately, you remove them from the wild before they breed.
Correct.
Yeah.
Which is why this isn't, that's not a sustainable way of farming. And this,
exactly,
it's such a complex issue. I do want to talk some more about it.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more with Taras Greshko about his book, Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Taras Greshko about his book, Bottom Feeder, about eating seafood ethically. So we say it's not time to despair. We only have a couple of minutes in this segment, and we'll come back on the other side of the news. What do people do who want to keep it all straight and eat food that's not going to damage themselves or the environment?
Well, there are a few really simple principles. Eat a little. The idea of the book is not that we should all be eating bottom feeders, but that we should become bottom feeders ourselves. That is, eat a little lower down in the food chain than we're currently eating. We have a tendency to eat the big predator fish like tuna and swordfish, grouper.
They're sticky. They remind us of meat.
Exactly, yeah. You can experiment by, a good principle is to eat a little lower down in the food chain. Try things like haddock as a substitute for cod and fish and chips. Go for farm trout instead of farm salmon. But also go for things like herring and mackerel, sardines, and anchoveta. My journey around the globe took me to a bunch of different cultures, and I discovered these traditions of eating lower down in the food chain. And actually, those are the most flavorful fish. They often have the most amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
They come from saltier oceans, so the amino acids sort of balance the salinity of the water. And they're used to make fantastic fish soups in the Mediterranean. There's a tradition of the Friday sardine barbecue in Portugal. And we can incorporate some of those traditions into our cuisine. Or they already exist in a lot of our big cities. There are Portuguese communities, Greek communities, that kind of thing, where they're already used to eating these fish. So, I mean, that's one thing to do.
As they get more and more, as some of those big fish get more and more expensive, I think those things will happen naturally anyway.
Yeah. And I've sort of just rejigged my eating habits so that I have salmon very occasionally now. But when I do, right, I splurge for good, wild salmon from,
right,
Alaska.
There's a delicious fish called cobia that we've been using in the restaurant recently, a much smaller fish than tuna and things like that, but has some of those same qualities. And I just think people need to look for alternatives out there.
Yeah, do you guys use the sable fish, for example?
We have.
Yeah, I think that's a great alternative to Chilean sea bass.
Mm-hmm.
It's sustainably fished in the Pacific right now. And it's got a nice oily flesh, almost buttery, really. And it's hard to overcook, which is the same thing with the Chilean.
When we come back after the news, Taras, I want to talk to you about your book, because your book isn't just a dry nonfiction book. It reads like an adventure, and I want to talk about your adventures in how you came up with this knowledge chasing fish all around the world. We'll be back after the news. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking with Taras Gresko about his wonderful book, Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. You can find out more about the book and even pick it up online at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Now, Taras, we were talking about the points, these very good points you're making in the book, and there's a lot for us to learn from reading your book, but this was really an adventure. You didn't sit in your library and Google all this stuff and write it down. You actually went around the world in search of the answers.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, seafood is sourced globally now, so I couldn't write sort of a seafood nation type book. I really had to get out there and visit the places where this stuff was coming from. So I started on a lobster boat in Nova Scotia, talked my way onto a purse center that was going out for sardines in Portugal, and visited some of the great markets of the world, like Skeechy in Tokyo and Billingsgate in London. But, I mean, one of the places that took me that was the most disturbing were the shrimp farms of India. And two of the most popular seafoods in North America right now are salmon and shrimp. We've all seen the all-you-can-eat shrimp specials in family restaurants across the United States. And a lot of that shrimp comes from these aquaculture ponds in the developing world, whether it's China, India, or Thailand. The ones I saw in India were really quite disturbing because they have to fill the ponds with water and antibiotics and fungicides in order to prevent the shrimp from dying off. There's so many in close proximity to each other. And that has a real impact on the people who live next to the shrimp ponds. Their groundwater is sucked up to provide the water for the ponds, and the water that's sent out back out into the environment has a real impact on their quality of life. I saw people with dysentery, sores all over their body because they were in close proximity to this antibiotic and fungicide choked water. Yeah, so I was coming back after experiences like that. Your mind tends to go back to the places that you've seen while doing the research. And I go for, when it comes to shrimp now, I go for the wild caught stuff. There's the Gulf of Maine shrimp, which is really good. But the fact is, when you do that, it becomes seasonal once again. You're not expecting
more
cheap protein all the time.
Right. We did a show a while back with the Mariah Jade, which is a
shrimper
in New Orleans that
right.
Serves wild American shrimp and ships around the country. We'll put the information for Mariah Jade back up on our website on this show for people who want to take a look and
buy
some
wild
American shrimp.
You know,
yeah, a great alternative.
You know, it's funny because agribusiness and these large corporate concerns, they often talk about how we need to make food safe by irradiating it or pasteurizing it or you know, the antibiotics and the fungicides will make your food safe. And what they are really is a way to allow us to make dirtier food and still be able
right.
to eat it. So
yeah.
the reason that those shrimp would die off in such close proximity is because
they're too close.
Well, because they're living in each other's filth. And
yeah.
and even if you put in fungicides and antibiotics, now they're living in each other's filth and not dying, but they're still living in each other's filth, mm-hmm. and then you're eating them. You know, it's like if the reason that, you know, agribusiness every once in a while comes along with a proposal to irradiate all meat in the United States. Because then, of course, they could use the filthiest practices they want. And you know, I don't want sterilized fecal matter in my food,
yeah.
only slightly less than I want non-sterilized fecal matter in my food.
Yeah, there's been no mad shrimp disease yet, but it
yeah,
could
yet.
Happen.
you know,
we're already feeding shrimp, ground-up shrimp heads, the process. And salmon, in particular, is which is a luxury food here. We expect good things out of it. I mean, their feed contains some really horrific things, you know, everything from roadkill to way too much soy. We're actually feeding salmon soy, which eliminates the omega-3 benefits of the finished product.
If you feed salmon soy, it eliminates the omega-3s in salmon?
Yeah, the only reason they've got tons of omega-3s is that they're feeding on krill and other smaller fish. They're concentrating it up the food chain, which is why they have relatively high amounts.
That's
another thing about the smaller species I talked about, sardines, anchoveta, mackerel. They're really high in omega-3s.
We have to feed whatever we're planning on eating, what it eats naturally, okay, whether it's cow, whether it's shrimp, whether it's salmon. And to do anything else affects the quality of what you're going to get in the end product. And that affects us flavor-wise, but it also affects us in the beneficial characteristics of what we're eating.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk since we put so much soy and corn oil into our diets starting about the 1960s. Our brains actually have lower levels of these beneficial omega-3s. They're chock full of omega-6s, and there's a real correlation between depression and things like Alzheimer's.
You spend a little time talking about the difference between omega-3s and omega-6s in your introduction there, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about what's going on in places where they're still eating a lot of wild fish and places like here where we're not.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the countries that have the highest consumption of fish, like Japan, Portugal, and Norway, they have much lower levels of depression, and that's sort of surprising in the case of Norway. They live pretty far north.
It's cold. It's cold. You should be depressed.
Yeah, exactly, and very, very long nights. The thing is that there's lower levels of coronary heart disease, too. And there's a lot of evidence that human beings evolved eating fish, that we evolved in the Rift Valley in Africa, eating catfish in particular, and lots of shellfish, judging from the shellfish middens, these mounds of shells they find in old, early human sites. So our brains probably developed, the only reason our brains developed is that we had a good source of marine protein early on.
What?
So I'm a firm believer in the idea that fish really is brain food and that we need at least the omega-3s in the capsule form.
And if you look at those Nordic countries where people are very healthy and very happy, surprisingly, considering, you know, we think about seasonal affective disorder here in the northeast of the United States, and they have very long nights, and there's a lower incidence of depression, as you mentioned. And, you know, they don't eat very many vegetables up there. That's not really a part of the diet.
Yeah, it's true. They looked at the Inuit, too, the Eskimos of Greenland. And, I mean, it's mostly, God, I mean, they had so much fat in their diet and so much fish and very few vegetables. But they were relatively healthy, especially in terms of coronary heart disease. So, I mean, I do think that Americans could be eating more fish. They currently eat about 44 pounds of fish a year, and I think that the Portuguese and the Japanese are closer to 150 pounds a year.
Well, in your book, you talk about how you made allusion to the all-you-can-eat shrimp buffets in the United States a little earlier in our conversation. In Bottom Feeder, you talk about how Red Lobster, the largest end user of seafood here, how they sort of try to lead you to believe or advertise in such a way that some might be led to believe that they source from local fisheries and that it's a local thing, but they really don't. What's been the impact of large-scale buying like Red Lobster, and what do they do?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're quite honest about it, upfront about it, in at least when they're testifying. not necessarily.
Under oath. Under oath they are.
Not necessarily in there. If you look at their menus are the most delocalized thing. I mean, they're actually, the idea is that they're from Maine. It's sort of a Maine seafood shack. But actually, there are no Red Lobsters in Maine. And it's,
that's because why would there be when you have
exactly.
Maine lobster in Maine?
Yeah, exactly. Most of their stuff, if you look at it, is a product of aquaculture. It's farmed. This is just in the case of shrimp, they were asked why they didn't buy from local shrimpers, from American shrimpers. And the response was that the product was too inconsistent and in size. So they want regular size, which is what the farms can provide. And they also want a regular source. And, of course, shrimping is seasonal. I mean, sometimes you got you get a good haul, and it's not available consistently all year round.
But even the wild American shrimp, you can at this point, you can get all year round if you're willing to pay a premium in the off-seasons for frozen.
Obviously, they don't want to pay that premium, which is the big problem. They can get it much cheaper as a source of farm protein from China in particular. And seafood that comes from China is really a big concern for me. I've been there. They have huge water pollution problems. They have far too much population, far too little water, and the shrimp farms are cheek by jowl with pig farms. There are things in the water that should not be in there, and the FDA is just too overstretched to inspect it all. They inspect only about 1.5%.
When we come back, I want to talk more about the FDA, but I just have one little point. If we're afraid to buy our plastic toys from China and our dog food from China, should we really be buying our shrimp from China?
Excellent point.
Speak wisely. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Taras Gresko about Bottom Feeder, how to eat ethically in a world of vanishing seafood. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're speaking with Taras Gresko about his book, Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. You can find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and find out more about him and even pick up the book if you like. Taras, we were talking before about how the FDA is not really doing the same, a bang-up job in inspecting our seafood. Europe does a much better job than we do, don't they?
Yeah, they do, and they'll regularly sort of slap on bans, like when all sorts of weird stuff was showing up in Pakistani seafood, including rusty nails and stuff like that. They slapped a ban on the whole country for a year.
Well,
they cleaned up their act.
They inspect about what percentage? Europe inspects about what percentage as opposed to our
I've heard estimates that's more like 20% versus 1.59% for the FDA.
And the reason that they impose those bans is if they're inspecting 20% and stuff keeps turning up in that 20% inspection, they're like, listen, we know we can't see everything, so we're having a problem with you. We'll now slap 100% inspection on this problematic source, whereas in the United States we just don't do that.
Well, the FDA, to their credit, when scandal about this broke, they banned 5 Chinese species, you know, like carp, or I think it was a fish called dace, until China cleaned up its act. But I think you have to take even more stringent measures. We really need to be encouraging sustainable aquaculture around the world. As it's done now, it's a terrible industry. But I've met people, you know, even species like salmon, there are intelligent alternatives to the way we're doing it now. It's being raised off the coast of British Columbia and Chile right now in these sea cages, which spread parasites and disease to local salmon runs in the case of British Columbia. There are guys who are actually raising pan-sized coho inland in British Columbia in concrete containment tanks, so there's no risk of diseases and parasites being spread to the wild.
Cross-contamination.
Yeah, exactly. And what they're doing is they're using the fertilizer, they're using the waste from these natural non-antibiotic-fed coho. You don't need to give them antibiotics if you keep them at low enough densities and away from contamination from the wild. And they're using the waste from these fish to fertilize their wasabi fields.
Very nice.
Yeah.
There are actually becoming more and more of these kind of, and you hear even certified organic salmon farms, and there are people who tell you that there's no such thing. But certainly there are better practices and worse practices.
Yeah, exactly.
And salmon, some of the farm-raised salmon, if people knew what these salmon were living in, they would just simply not eat them.
Yeah, definitely. They're packed so tight, a million in some of the farms, at the density of battery hens, there's basically a cloud of feces going down about 90 feet, and they're eating their own feces. They're also, you know, being fed artificial pigments, as we know. There's this thing called a Salmo fan, where you can pick out the color of your the end color of your salmon.
And forget about all that. Then when you're done with the fish, even forget about how you raised it and whether you think that's the right way it should be raised, and even how it's affecting other species and other salmon. The fish doesn't have the same nutritive benefits than fish that are fed appropriate foods do.
And what about taste? I mean,
and about taste? Of course,
I grew up eating wild salmon in British Columbia, and fantastic, well muscled fish. The stuff you get now is, the flesh isn't firm; it's actually gooey. There's the fat is disgusting; it tastes like saliva. I mean, it's really not the fish that I grew up with.
You know, I think a lot of folks around here, because we do, when the salmon, and some of the salmon runs are shut down this year because they were so low, returning salmon populations. But
in California and Oregon, in particular.
Yeah. But it's fairly expensive when we get river salmon over
fairly
here.
Fairly expensive, $40 a pound this
yeah,
year.
It's nutty expensive. It was only 20-something last year. But
Copper River is through the roof right now.
But when people have it, the reaction we get in the restaurant, as I say, and I always like to have two salmon on the menu. We have, like, okay, we have the salmon on the menu for $27, and then we have the salmon on the menu for $40 or $45 because that's just what it costs.
Right.
And people who are adventurous and say, four, five, are you, all right, well, I'll try it. And they all universally admit, it's a different fish. Mm-hmm. It's a different substance entirely to have wild fish.
But I want to warn people, and we're talking a lot about salmon here, and there are other fish that are probably even a bigger problem than salmon, but I want to warn you, if you're paying $2 a pound for salmon, paying $3 a pound for salmon, you can almost guarantee that it's coming from one of the farms that we're talking about.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, unless it's pink or, you know, one of the little fish that people tend not to like and are still quite abundant, the pink salmon. It's coming from a farm, you know, $4.99 a pound, which is what you can get it for in some supermarket chains. That's guaranteed to be farmed. And unfortunately, for a while there in British Columbia, that was bringing down the price of the wild salmon.
Yeah.
Well,
now the price is going up because we're realizing how scarce it is.
Well, another thing is, very often there's a lot of people selling fish out there under false pretenses, right? If it's too good to be true, it's probably not true.
Yeah, Consumer Reports did a survey across the United States, and they found that about 56% of the salmon that was sold, being sold as wild, was actually farmed.
Right.
There's a lot of species substitution in the seafood industry too, where your grouper is actually turning out to be, I don't know, Pangasius or bassa imported from Asia. If it's too good to be true, if it's too cheap to be true, then it isn't true.
Well, Taras Gresko's book is Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. And in the back, there's a wonderful guide to help you through all this. And it's also just a wonderful read.
I'll tell you, Taras, I know the book is relatively new, but I think it's going to become a very important book in aquaculture.
Yeah, well, and I hope the wild fisheries do. And I hope it makes people think about what they eat. I've changed my eating habits, but I actually eat more fish than I used to. I've just sort of changed the species I select, and I think my diet's a lot richer right now.
Well, it's a great book, and thanks for coming on our show.
A real pleasure. Thanks, guys.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking about fish.
Yeah, Taras's book, it really is an important book, and it really does give you some guidelines. There are so many divergent views out there and things to confuse us about what we should be eating and what we shouldn't be eating.
Well, it's kind of,
people are giving us some kind of highways and byways as far as produce and for meat, and I think not enough people are telling us as far as seafood what we're doing wrong and what we're doing right.
Because it's harder to understand, because if you say, oh, I get this from that farm, you can drive by it. You can look at it on a map. You can look at them grow their vegetables. Are the chemicals there? You know, are they organic? Do you know the guy? Can you go visit Ben Canapaki and talk about Indike Farms? Well, it's harder with seafood because unless you go down to the dock, you know, and even if you do go down to the dock, what kind of fishing gear do they use? You know, all these things are important.
Very important.
It's from a fish farm. Fish farms aren't on the side of the road. You can go visit the fish farm, swim around with little fishies in there.
How you fish is very, very important. If you destroy the seafood floor, the oceanic floor, while you're fishing, it, you know, it takes hundreds of years for that to return.
Or it may never return.
Or it may never return. You know, and I was couldn't help but think earlier in the show when he was talking about some of the big fish that we've just overeaten, and we've eaten 90% of them out of the ocean.
90% of the big fish and the biomass was 10% of what it was in 1950.
I couldn't help but think that maybe the mercury scare will help some of the big fish return as people become more and more afraid of mercury and large
and
fish.
And we didn't deal with it as much in this book, but Taras also addresses mercury in large fish. And it is a complex issue, but I do love fish, and this book is tremendous. Both for the book itself and the appendix at the end, where he basically summarizes most of the fish that are locally available.
And just like he said, if we eat some smaller fish, people closer to the bottom, fish closer to the bottom of the food chain, we'll do better.
We shouldn't eat people at all.
Sorry, fish closer to the bottom.
Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as I have listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Shaw.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 12 noon.